The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September.
Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. Close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him, how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run.
To Autumn by William Blake. O Autumn, laden with fruit and stained with the blot of the grape, pass not, but sit beneath my shady roof. There thou mayst rest and tune thy jolly voice to my fresh pipe, and all the daughters of the year shall dance. Sing now the lusty song.
To bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core. To swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel. To set budding more and still more. Later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease. For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells.
Toi tu m'aimais, et je t'aimais. Nous vivions tous les deux ensemble. Toi qui m'aimais.
Moi the summer is over and the new publishing season is underway. The next few weeks will determine the big winners and losers of the publishing year as fortunes are won and lost in pursuit of that Christmas winner capable of turning the balance sheets from red to black. But the celebrity tomes and stocking fillers can wait for now. It's fiction we're interested in. What are the novels you should be reading? The Man Booker jury sprung a few surprises a few weeks ago with some novels that hadn't yet been published. A handful of their authors made their first public appearances at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where Richard Lee and I have been rounding them up. But first, to one of the better-known longlistees, Tash Orr, a Malaysian writer who first came to our attention back in 2005, when we longlisted the Harmony Silk Factory for the Guardian First Book Prize. He talked to Richard about his latest novel, Five Star Billionaire.
Look around your house. I bet half your stuff says made in China. And most of that will have been shipped from here, Shanghai. Within 20 years, China will be the world's number one economic superpower.
Every building has its own sparkle, its own identity. At night, their electric personalities flicker into life and they cast off their perfunctory daytime selves, reaching out to each other to form a new world of ever-changing colour. It is tempting to see them as a single mass of light, a collection of illuminated billboards and fancy fluorescent strips that twinkle in the same way. But this is not true, they are not the same. Each one insists itself upon you in a different way, leaving its imprint on your imagination. Each message, if you care to listen, is different. From his window, he could see the Pudong skyline. The skyscrapers of Lujiazui ranged like razor-sharp alpine peaks against the night sky. In the daytime, even the most famous buildings seem irrelevant, obscured by the perpetual haze of pollution. But at night, when the yellow-grey fog thinned, he would sit at his window watching them display boastfully, each one trying to outdo the next, taller, louder, brighter. A crystal outcrop suspended high in the sky, shrouded by mist on rainy days. A giant goldfish wriggling across the face of a building. Interlocking geometric shapes shattering into a million fragments before regrouping. He knew every one by heart. Buildings were in his DNA, he sometimes thought. They had given him everything he had ever owned, his houses, his cars, his friends, and even shaped the way he thought and felt. They had been in his life right from the beginning. The years were rushing past, whatever he had left of his youth surrendering to middle age. Yet bricks and mortar, real estate, remained a constant presence. When he revisited his earliest memories, trying to summon scenes of family life, his mother's protective embrace, perhaps, or praise from his father, the results were always blank. They were present in his memories, of course, his parents and grandmother, hovering spectrally. But, just like in real life, they were never animated. All he could see and smell was the buildings around them, the structures they inhabited, cold stone floors, mossy walls, flaking plaster, silence. It was a world from which there had been no escape. A path had been laid down for him, straight and unbending. He had long since given up hope of departing from this track, indeed could not even remember any other option, until he came to Shanghai. Every time I went back to Malaysia, I noticed that more and more people were leaving Malaysia to go abroad. I mean, that in itself is not unusual because people have always done that. But traditionally, people have left to seek a better life in the great cities of the West. What I noticed was slowly but surely, more and more people were going to China rather than the West. And it somehow seemed to me that China was sort of slowly replacing the American dream, that gave the illusion of unlimited possibility. And so I too began to travel and live in China, in particular Shanghai, which is, you know, the most obvious symbol of the new China and all that it represents. And there I began to meet people who were from, you know, from all over the world, but particularly from Asia. Those were the people, those were the migrants who really interested me, people from Malaysia and Singapore in particular, people who were just like me.
It's a novel of transformation where your characters, they reinvent themselves in Shanghai. I mean, is this kind of possibility of reinventing yourself, is that what it feels like to be in Southeast Asia at the moment?
East Asia and Southeast Asia, which are really the regions I know best, are aggressively trying to sort of promote this idea that the future is endless, it's full of possibility. Our very difficult, very turbulent recent pasts are something that we can forget by looking ever forward. And I think that this sense of possibility is magnified in a very big city like Shanghai, in which you can lose yourself, but still feel that anything is possible, simply because it's so anonymous. Because there's a flip side, which is the loneliness that a lot of the characters feel.
I mean, Phoebe and Gary, two of your characters, they come from rural poverty with kind of nothing to lose. And whereas Justin and Ying Hui, they're from the Malaysian elite. So, I mean, it's kind of, it's both ends of society are doing the same kind of rush to Shanghai.
Absolutely. I mean, that was what really struck me when I first started thinking about the novel and observing the kind of people who are moving to China to start in a new life. It wasn't just a particular group of people. It wasn't the low-skilled manual labourers that one might expect, or actually, you know, the mega-rich. It was all sorts of people. You know, it was florists, yoga teachers, lifestyle coaches, and of course bankers and you know, people wanting to start their own businesses. It seemed to me that everyone was going, and I was just really fascinated to see how the China dream appealed in such a powerful way to such a broad spectrum of Asian people. And so I began to write this novel about how Asians see China and how, in fact, they see themselves and what it is they see in China that they can't find back home.
Gary is the only one of your characters who makes it into the present tense. Is that because, in a sense, he's kind of the emotional heart of the book?
I think in some ways, Gary probably gets to know himself better than the others by the time we reach the end of the book. I think they all achieve a certain degree of self-awareness.
Because we meet him as at the top of his arc in terms of fame, don't we? And then he goes down from there. I mean, he wins a talent contest, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's someone who's won a talent competition at the age of 16, 17, then gets propelled into celebrity, which is this sort of vague thing that a lot of young people in Asia, I guess across the world, are now obsessed by. They just want to be famous. The kind of talent competitions that we have in Britain are replicated with great joy and enthusiasm all over Asia. And you have scores of young, hundreds, thousands of young people every day, wanting to become a pop star. And that's exactly what happens to Gary. He has this life that everyone wants. And then things sort of unravel. And they unravel against the backdrop of Shanghai, which is a big, kind of quite exciting but also quite cruel place. And he has to go through a lot of ups and downs before
reaching.
It's kind
of unmasking, isn't it? This image is kind of shown to be not real, not true in some way.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about reinvention. Gary, of course, arrives in Shanghai already reinvented. So he doesn't actually have to use the city to reinvent himself. So for him, the city is about a process of reversing this process of reinvention, stripping back the layers and finding out who he is. Whereas for a lot of the others, the city is an opportunity to add on layer after layer of pretense.
Yeah, Phoebe, for example, just picking up somebody else's ID and turning that, parlaying that into a series of slightly better jobs.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, where the self-help idea filters into the book in a really powerful way, because what I found when I was living in Shanghai was that this culture of self-help, which is essentially it's a very American thing, and we have it in Europe, but it's not as powerful as it is, say, in America, has been seized upon by the Chinese in a really big way. And it really struck me as ironic that China and America, who see themselves, often as polar opposites of each other, share this one thing in common, which is this huge optimism that you can improve everything about your life. And more importantly, that you can fix everything by reading a book. And everywhere I went in Shanghai, people were reading self-help books. They were being sold on the pavement. All those knockoff copies were being sort of consumed voraciously. And Phoebe, I guess, falls into this very quickly, into this this culture of wanting to prove herself, and actually believes that she can and does succeed to a certain degree.
But at a certain cost, of course. I mean, it's a world in constant motion where nothing ever stays still. It's a world where if you stand still for a moment, the river rushes past you. How do you capture such vertiginous change in a slow-moving form like the novel?
One just has to sort of hope that the rhythms of the city filter into the novel. That's how I approached it. There is a sort of slightly sprawling epic quality to the novel. It's not overly long, it's just over 450 pages. I try to allow my writing to be the conduit, to allow what I was experiencing to filter onto the page. And so actually, even though the characters experience great change, there is also a stillness to the novel. And contrasted, of course, to Shanghai, which is their very fast-moving present, is their very deeply rooted past lives in Malaysia, which is really what anchors the book.
Absolutely. The characters often seem unsettled by moments of stillness. There's Gary, who's happy in Ibiza, where the music is so loud it erased everything inside him, or Ying Hui, who says she could never stand emptiness and stillness was even worse. I mean, is that how it feels in a big city like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that, in modern day Asia, we've become so conditioned to thinking of constant change as being a good thing. There's this incessant forward drive that actually stillness unsettles people. Ying Hui very religiously goes to her yoga sessions, but she just can't bear any kind of suggestion of, she wants to improve herself, but she can't bear any kind of suggestion of physical stillness, because it sort of makes her think about where she's from. That's why they're all addicted to the rhythm of Shanghai, because it provides a distraction to what they might otherwise have to be thinking about, which is who they are and where they come from and what they're really looking for in life.
Shanghai is almost like a character itself. Did you want to kind of paint a portrait of the city as a person, almost?
As I began to go deeper into the novel, it seemed to me that I couldn't ignore the character of the city itself. I mean, I had a very strong personal relationship with the city. I mean, I began to see it as a real force in itself, as it does have a personality. It really does have a personality. And you know, even at its stillest moments, I always felt that it was a city in movement.
Despite its size, the world you paint seems almost claustrophobic. I mean, Phoebe's roommate meets Justin. Yinghui and Walter go to the bar where Gary gets into a fight and his career kind of explodes.
People have a funny way of being drawn to each other. People from the same kind of backgrounds. That's certainly what has happened to me all throughout my life. You know, living in a big city like London, for example, and in an even bigger city like Shanghai, unwittingly, I always get drawn to people from Malaysia, and not just from Malaysia, but from very specific parts of Malaysian society. And I think it's because unwittingly, in a really inarticulated way, we're looking to establish these connections. And I think there's a sense in which big cities intensify coincidence.
At the end, I mean, without giving too much away, your characters each, in some way, discover the limits of the reinvention that they've imposed or that they've searched for in Shanghai.
And I think, you know, by the time we get to the end of the book, I don't think any of the characters have really rejected that in an outright fashion. It's still part of their lives. I think they've just been forced to confront, in a slightly more profound way, why it is exactly that they want to get rich, or they want a new life, or why they want a new partner, for example. And I think it seems almost too obvious to say this, but in a culture that is evolving so quickly, some kind of reflection is necessary in order to make those forward advancements useful.
Yeah, or indeed, to keep those forward advancements healthy and sustainable.
Yeah, or meaningful, to have any sense of them, because otherwise it's just blind rush forward. And I've just spent 5 months living in Singapore, and there is definitely a sense there in which materialism has blindly become the way of life. And a lot of people chase it without really knowing why they're doing it.
Is that the job of the artist, of the novelist, to remind people there's something else there?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, a novel has to serve some other purpose than just pure entertainment. I mean, it has to work at some deeper level. It has to question the way we live.
Tashor, and Five-Star Billionaire is published by Fourth Estate. Now, I mentioned that Tash is one of the better-known writers among the so-called Booker Dozen. That's the 13 books on the long list. His novel's been out there since the spring. Not so Richard House, whose inclusion with The Kills took everyone by surprise. Not only was it his debut, but it had yet to be published. Reviewing it in The Guardian, Kate Pullinger described it as a gripping, hallucinogenic and enormous novel that deals with the aftermath of the Iraq conflict. Richard Lee's back with us. Tell us a bit about The Kills.
Well, it is genuinely big. It consists of four books and arrives in paper as a mammoth 1,000-plus page volume. Or it's also published in an enhanced edition, which I haven't seen yet, for tablets and smartphones.
Which Pullinger actually says is the better read.
Because the first two books in particular are augmented by a series of short films which are embedded on the page, often with bits of text overlaid, as well as animations and audio clips. It sounds fascinating.
It'd be great if that got through onto the shortlist, won't it? We'll know that next week. But The Kills isn't the only big book on the Booker list, or the only one listed before publication. There's also a new novel from Eleanor Catton, a New Zealander whose dizzying debut novel, The Rehearsal, was frontrunner for the Guardian First Book Prize back in 2009. Dizzying seems to be Catton's adjective, because here she is back again with a dizzyingly ambitious doorstep of a book, which is set in the 19th century New Zealand goldfields and takes in astronomy, ghosts, unsolved crimes, all that sort of thing. We have yet to review it in The Guardian. It's sitting on my bedside table as we speak. But one of the first reviews in The Scotsman described it as New Zealand's answer to Wilkie Collins, with all its fake identities, stolen gold sneaked into the linings of dresses, opium dealers and murder. Sounds like just the sort of thing for as the evenings are drawing in. Are either of these books the future of fiction? Well, we'll get a step nearer to finding out next week when the Booker Dozen is whittled down to a shortlist of six. But the man Booker isn't everything, not least because it only admits novels published in the UK and Commonwealth. Richard, there are a couple of big American novels about to land, aren't there?
Yes, Stephen King is publishing a sequel to his 1977 novel, The Shining, immortalised on film by Jack Nicholson, of course. It's called Dr. Sleep and is out from Hodder & Stoughton on the 24th of September. They're promising polyester-clad senior citizens who turn out to be child-torturing paranormals with fangs beneath their dentures. So just the usual fare from Stephen King.
And from the sublime to the, well, different sort of sublime, there's a new Thomas Pynchon novel coming out next month. It's called The Bleeding Edge, and it is billed as a riotous comedy set in 2001 New York between the bursting of the dot-com bubble and the shock of September the 11th. Richard, Pynchon-esque seems to have become a genre all of its own. It's been applied to a novel I know you're very keen on, which is Sergio de la Parva's A Naked Singularity.
Yes, this is a great backstory to this book, because it's a book that he wrote a little while back and published himself in 2008, having despaired of ever finding an agent who would take it on. And you can kind of see why. It's a big brute of a book. It's undeniably a little bit messy. But he found a publisher after some good reviews online, and it was published last year by Chicago University Press, and has got on to win prizes. And it's just a terrific read. It's a great voice. It's very exciting. It's very ambitious, bursting with ideas. Indeed, Pynchon-esque. Other people have cited William Gaddis as another kind of inspiration. It's great. It kind of detonates the legal thriller in the most entertaining kind of way.
If your tastes are for lighter entertainment, there's a new Bridget Jones from Helen Fielding. It's called Mad About the Boy, and it's out on October the 10th from Jonathan Cape. Expect much Twitter about Twitter, along with bigger issues of encroaching middle age. There's also The Goldfinch from Donna Tartt, which is out from Little Brown on the 22nd of October. Donna's become one of the perennially long-awaited after her hugely successful The Secret History. It's only her fourth novel since 1992. And it's an elegant exploration of love, loss, art and obsession involving a young boy and a painting that reminds him of his dead mother. So much for the big hitters, Richard. You've picked out some other ones, haven't you?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of big hitters I'm looking forward to as well. There's Jhumpa Lahiri, Bloomsbury, bringing out in September Jhumpa Lahiri's novel The Lowland, which is a novel of two brothers in Kolkata in the late 20th century, whereas one of them is getting increasingly radicalised, and it's kind of the effect of that on his family and so on. There's also Elizabeth Gilbert, who's wrote Eat, Pray, Love a little while back, who's got a big novel of the 19th century called The Signature of All Things. And Dave Eggers, who's Hologram for the King, I much enjoyed, I think, earlier this year, is back again in kind of internet company territory with The Circle. It's a kind of sprawling California campus with a company which links together email, social media, banking and purchasing into one identity, kind of shades of the NSA there. I remember him being pretty good on the tech stuff. He kind of understands how the tech companies work and does that very well in Hologram for the King. So I think The Circle should be one to look out for. But on the kind of smaller end of things, there's an author who we championed with The Guardian for the Guardian First Book Award, Juan Pablo Villalobos, who's back with a second called Quesadillas, which is a political satire. I've only just started this, but it's already kind of, it's very enjoyable. It's a great voice. It's full of a lot of energy and bounce. It's a family struggling for food in rural Mexico with a foul-mouthed father and six kids living in a shoebox with a lid made of a sheet of asbestos. Just read a nice riff on inflationary quesadillas, normal quesadillas, devaluation quesadillas, and poor man's quesadillas, depending on how much cheese there is left in them. And another book, again, that is slightly less well known in the UK, I'm sure, is an author called Bernard Coman, who's from Switzerland. He's an editor at Éditions du Seuil and won the Goncourt de la Nouvelle in 2011 for his short story collection Tout Passe, which I thought was great. And this is his debut novel, which is he's got a fascinating kind of life. He experimented with drugs as a kid, kind of with his parents' collusion or something. I'm not entirely sure of the details of that. But he's suffered from kind of odd memory problems ever since. And this is a novel about a man who's indeed suffering with memory problems, who makes a deal that he'll inherit the memory of an old man if he becomes his live-in servant. And it's kind of as his demands become more and more bizarre, the novel progresses. But I'm looking forward to that as well.
Plenty to get your teeth into there, then. But finally, to a novelist as English as baked beans and Marmite, who made his first appearance a quarter of a century ago with the satirical novel What a Carve-Up, which defined that other low-down dishonest decade, the 1980s. Yes, it's Jonathan Coe, who has travelled back to an earlier decade with his latest novel, Expo 58. The expo in question is Belgium's World Fair. Jonathan came into the studio to introduce us to his hapless hero, Thomas, and the society of diplomatic toadies who gathered in Brussels on the eve of the fair to toast the Great British Project. J'aime pas les grosses voitures.
Thomas would remember it for years afterwards as being one of the great moments of his life. It was not long after dusk, and he'd entered the Expo Park by the Porte des Attractions, showing his newly issued delegate's pass to the security guard, who would never ask to see it again. Passing by the as-yet silent and unopened amusement park on his left, he entered the Place de Belgique, then took a right turn. This avenue, too, was quiet. The cable cars stood empty and motionless high above him, their bodies thrown into brilliant relief by the fluorescent light which gleamed out from innumerable futuristic lampposts placed along the walkways. As for the Atomium, it was now directly ahead of him, and Thomas caught his breath when he saw it. Each one of the aluminium spheres was festooned with a criss-crossing network of silver lights, and the effect was at once festive, majestic, and otherworldly, as if this were a Christmas celebration on the planet of some far-flung galaxy. Raising his eyes hundreds of feet to the topmost sphere, Thomas could see the warmer, yellower lights of the restaurant, the very place towards which his eager footsteps were now leading him. A liveried footman welcomed him into the ground floor reception area and showed him to the lift, which was furnished with a glass roof so that the passenger might have a sense of the speed of his passage up through the central column. And indeed, it seemed incredibly fast. Thomas's ears were already popping when the lift hissed and braked its way to a gentle halt. The doors whooshed open and he stepped out into the restaurant. A British embassy functionary was waiting outside the lift with a typewritten list of invited guests. "Ah, good evening, Mr. He consulted the sheet of paper. "Mr. Foley, isn't it?" "Foley." "Really? Sure. Quite sure. Okay then. Tickety-boo." He crossed Thomas's name off the list. "I'm Simon Hebblethwaite, Sir John's Secretary General. Have you been introduced to Sir John?" "Not as such, no. We attended a meeting together in London." "Ah. Well, anyway, it's jolly good of you to come at such short notice. Someone from the Industries Pavilion had to drop out at the last minute, and it would have looked bad to have a spare place at the table." "I see. Yes, that would have been awkward. Well, do help yourself to a drink. There's a few bottles of fizz. I should get a couple of glasses down before it runs out and we have to fall back on the standard French plonk." Thomas took a glass of champagne from one of the waitresses and, realising at once that it would be hard to get into conversation with any of the already tightly knit groups that had formed throughout the room, he wandered over to one of the vast plate glass windows. It didn't bother him for now that his invitation to this dinner had obviously been an afterthought, or that nobody here had any interest in him. He could have stood forever by that window, sipping champagne and looking down on the multicoloured lights of this incredible new metropolis. So busy, so modern, shimmering with life and promise. He felt that he was looking into the future, from the clearest and loftiest vantage point that the technological ingenuity of man could devise. He felt like a king of the universe. For dinner, he took his allotted place at a table for four. The entire restaurant seemed to have been booked out for this occasion, and although Thomas's table, like all the others, was next to a window and offered the usual panorama of the expo site, it was also about as far removed from Sir John Balfour and the other VIPs as it was possible to be. He found it surprising, then, that he was seated next to James Gardner, the designer of the British Pavilion. For Thomas, this felt like a special and very intimidating honour. Also at the table were one Roger Braintree, introduced as secretary to the commercial councillor of the British Embassy in Brussels, and a tall, softly spoken Belgian lady called Ilka Shears, who held some position, never quite explained, on one of the committees responsible for advising on the musical component of the different nations' contributions. "Well, ladies and gentlemen," said Mr. Gardner to the other three, raising his glass, "let us drink a toast to Expo 58. By golly, we made it. Here we are, bang on time, and only a few more nails and screws to bash in before Thursday. Nothing short of a miracle, if you ask me. Let's allow ourselves a small pat on the back." "To Expo 58, Thomas echoed. "And to Great Britain," said Miss Shears gallantly, "whose contribution will, I'm sure, be one of the finest." They began to eat. The first course involved prawns and onions and something liquid and grey. Closer identification than that was difficult. Thomas found it rather pleasant. Roger Braintree ate his portion quickly and determinedly with a scowl of concentration on his face. He seemed to regard it as an unwelcome interruption rather than a conversational overture, when Miss Shears turned to him and said, "And will you be attending the opening ceremony on Thursday, Mr. Braintree?" "Not if I can help it," he replied, through his latest mouthful. Miss Shears flinched slightly, as if from an insect bite. "You don't want to be present on this historic occasion? Something to tell your grandchildren?" "Do you?" "Of course, an opportunity to see our king, to hear his speech." Roger Braintree grunted and speared another prawn. Being British, I would have thought you enjoyed a certain amount of pomp and pageantry. Well, we get plenty of that at home. But this, Mr. Braintree, surely this is unique and unrepeatable. So many nations coming together when a few years ago we were all fighting each other. America and the Soviet Union standing side by side, the exchange of ideas, the declaration of commitment to a shared vision of the future. Roger Braintree said nothing at first. Then, after dabbing at his lips with a napkin for a few moments, his only comment was, "You have a very European way of looking at things." The British are part of Europe, I think. Yes, but we prefer things to be rather more solid than our continental allies. Might I trouble you to pass the bread, please?
So many of the elements of this novel. I mean, Thomas regards this as one of the high points of his life, but he's a sort of unconsidered extra at an event that doesn't mean anything.
This really vast and important and celebratory event, which had taken place just a few hundred miles across the Channel, had been entered into, you know, a bit grudgingly and a bit sceptically by the British with this note of, you know, slightly snobby amusement, which seemed to me to be characteristic of Britain's attitude to Europe at that time. Expo 58, you know, one of the things I love about it and loved about it as soon as I started researching it, it was very, very cutting edge, you know, musically, architecturally, you know, the amazing modernism of the Phillips Pavilion and so on. Here was good old James Gardner doing his best to kind of drag Britain really into this modern era and sort of meeting opposition at every step of the way, really. Not a kind of militant opposition, but just a sort of relaxed, easygoing, slightly arrogant, aristocratic indifference to the whole notion of the modern.
It's Belgium, 1958. It's the first novel you've written set before your lifetime. Is that right?
That's more or less true. I wrote a novel a few years ago called The Rain Before It Falls, which started in the 40s, and quite a lot of that narrative was set in the 40s and 50s. But when I wrote The Rain Before It Falls, I created a big family dynasty, really, and had a big family tree planned out. I just kind of looked at that family tree and thought, well, you know, this could be Rosamund's brother-in-law, this could be Thomas who goes there. And, you know, I like the idea that these books coexist independently, but they also have a relationship to each other, and that, you know, readers who are alert enough to pick up on the connections will get a little kick out of that.
You write with great affection, which you see a little bit of in that passage, for the Belgians. The humour of the Belgians in placing the Russian pavilion next to the US one, reminding us, of course, that the Cold War is raging.
I've spent a little bit of time in Belgium over the last few years. There's a writer's residence there, which I've been invited to on a few occasions. And it was there, really, that I first started having conversations with people about Expo 58 and how large it looms in the Belgian consciousness. It's a fascinating country, politically very, very complex and indeed chaotic, almost comically chaotic a lot of the time. To deal really with their position in Europe, their history of having been invaded, the Belgians have evolved quite a unique sense of humour, I would say, quite a surreal sense of humour. That didn't occur to me when I first learned that the Soviet and American pavilions were placed side by side, but as soon as I mentioned that to a Belgian journalist, he said, of course, that's the Belgian sense of humour. We did it, you know, we did it to create mischief. There is some kind of chord struck, some kind of synergy between what I do and what the Belgians like to read and what they like to laugh at. So, you know, it's more a temperamental thing, really.
You have particularly the two spies in this, which do rather remind one of Hergé's Thompson and Thompson.
I'm not a huge Tintin reader, so it's not really that. But really, you know, as the epigraph to the book flags up, they're based on the characters of Charters and Caldecott from Hitchcock's Lady Vanishes.
And you call them by the names of the actors, the second names of the actors who played those characters, which I felt rather proud of myself and tracking down.
Oh, well done. Well done. I mean, the naming of the characters in this novel is quite careful, I have to say. It's quite a postmodern, quite elusive book in a way. There are a lot of references to British films, not just The Lady Vanishes, but the Bulting Brothers films of the 1950s. Two of the characters are called Carter and Wilkins after the teachers in the Jennings books. So, you know, I've really gone to town on my love of British comedy and references to it in this book.
Can we just talk about your attitude to comedy? You've written recently in the London Review of Books about how you think that satirical comedy is sort of finished. And yet you're known for satire. What a carve-up. The first novel that really brought you to prominence was very satirical.
What a carve-up was very satirical, but I've started to get a bit jumpy about people referring to my other books as satirical, because I think What a Carve-Up is really the only genuinely satirical book that I've written. You know, now, of course, I look at the country we've created 20 years after I wrote What a Carve-Up, and it's far more aggressively and depressingly Thatcherite than anything I could have imagined in my worst nightmares. So, you know, so much for the power of satirical fiction, really, is what I've been thinking to myself. You know, I love comedy. I love laughing. As the times we're living in get darker, I kind of seek that out, really, and the way we all long for Woody Allen to make a really straightforward, funny film again. But at the same time, there's a different kind of laughter you find a lot in this country, which is just a kind of slightly cynical, slightly accepting sort of giggling or sniggering, as Peter Cook called it, which I think, you know, lets a lot of the people that it's directed at off the hook. I singled out Boris Johnson in that piece in the LRB because he's kind of taken that one step further and has become so good at generating this kind of laughter himself, around himself, and directed at himself, that he's built up this kind of impermeable Teflon wall of laughter, which kind of shields him from any real sort of direct criticism. There are some things in this country, like the banking crisis, for instance, that we laugh about a bit too much, really, and that, because that's the easy thing to do, just to make jokes about, oh, aren't all bankers greedy and corrupt? Well, yes, what are we going to do about it? I mean, I did want to write kind of pure comedy with this book. There is some gentle satire aimed at the British attitude towards Europe, and that, I suppose, if the book has an underlying political theme, it's that. It's how does Britain think of itself in relationship to Europe? Has the way that we thought of our position in Europe changed much since 1958?
And at the very centre of the British exhibition, the British pavilion, was the Britannia, a pub. Mm-hmm.
It's modelled on a yachting club. It's not a kind of oldy English inn with a thatched roof and pewter tankards and that kind of thing. It's light and airy and modern and contemporary. It was a great success and a great attraction. Not just among British visitors to Expo, but to people from all countries. So it was actually one aspect of the pavilion that played very well. Then, as I understand it, it came back to the UK. The effects, the fixtures and fittings were auctioned off in Birmingham. They finished up in a pub in Dover, which was called the Britannia, which has a website devoted to it, which I found. And, yeah, it was a kind of sad story of steady decline, really, and it became a lap dancing club in about 5 or 6 years ago and then closed down altogether. It's currently, I think it was the building itself was demolished a couple of years ago. Again, it became a ready-made metaphor for how all those dreams and all that faith in the future, which Expo 58 represents, didn't always pan out the way people would have liked them to.
Jonathan Coe. Expo 58 is published by Viking Penguin. And that's it from us for this week. So thanks to Tash Orr and Jonathan Coe. From me, Claire Armistead, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.